Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 30th, 2004. Today's session number is MED 2004-03. Today's speaker is David Mezenbring. The lesson for today is Broadening Community to Better Discern the Summons, Regime Change in South Africa, More Change and Less Violence. Let's listen in.
And the title of this session is Regime Change in South Africa, More Change and Less Violence. And since we're doing this in 2004, I hope the implications of the title are obvious. Let me first disclose what my exposure to South Africa has been. More to give you a sense of what I don't know than anything else. I'm not a scholar on South Africa. I don't go back and forth. I don't stay current with the literature or anything like that. I lived in the country for 2 years in 76 and 77 and had what South Africans told me was an unusually broad experience in urban and rural, black and white areas. Learned to speak a black language enough to...
Which one?
Xhosa.
Ah.
You speak Xhosa?
I wish I did. I spent a month there.
Where?
In South Africa, out in, what's it called? Out in the rural area.
Okay, in the Transkei?
Yes.
Oh, okay, where you would have heard a lot of Xhosa.
Yes.
Yeah. Who else have? I know, Rick, you've been in South Africa once.
Just once, yes.
But fairly recently.
It was a year and a half ago.
Okay, and when did you have that month?
2 years ago.
And you were out in the country, or were you in Mthatha?
Excuse me?
Were you in the city of Mthatha, or were you out in the countryside?
That sounds familiar, but I can't remember. I was mostly out in the countryside.
Okay.
To Indibeli and trying to remember other pieces. I don't know. I get in the back of a truck and they take me places.
Right. Here's the Transkei region. These are heavy mountains, and this region where the mountains tumble down to the sea is as close to being unconquered by whites as any part of this region. Well, certainly Lesotho, and then this traditional black. They were the reservations until independence in 94.
And Mandela was from.
Mandela is from the Transkei. Both Nelson and Winnie came from the Transkei originally. And anybody else traveled in South Africa? Tell us a little bit about what your experience is. How long ago?
I was there 5 years ago. We were in Cape Town, Durban, Soweto, Joburg. Mm-hmm. And we went to Khayelitsha, which is a women's group. A million people living outside of Cape Town near the airport between the atomic energy plant and the airport.
And that was a study tour of Vermont?
It was with the Southwest Washington Synod, David Wold.
Okay.
Put it together.
And you folks?
I was there for a month in January of 2001.
Okay.
And I was there in 97 with an ELCA women exchange, companion Senate exchange. We were in Johannesburg and Pretoria and Bloemfontein and East London and Port Elizabeth, and then kind of out in a black area outside of East London.
Okay. East Elizabeth, East London, Bloemfontein, in the heart of the Orange Free State, deep south. Anybody else?
About a year in Namibia and went to Cape Town for Christmas in December.
Okay. When I left South Africa, I spent a dozen years or so in an advocacy role, so I stayed fairly current with the anti-apartheid movement, at least from outside the country. Went in a couple of times, but without visas, so I was very restricted in what I could do. And then worked as a grant maker for 3 or 4 years, and did a lot of travel, and had a lot of contact with South Africans then, because I had a budget of $250,000 a year to make grants to strengthen the role of South African churches in overcoming apartheid. And did things like inaugurate a fax network among the Council of Churches about 88, which was a very hot time in the struggle. And I've since been told that fax network was widely used by the anti-apartheid community because the mail was heavily censored. And it was common knowledge that people would put out in Johannesburg, they'd put out notice of a meeting somewhere around the country, and nobody would ever get the notices. But faxes, it was always controversial whether people could read them, whether the system could read the faxes or not, but at least they didn't stop it from going through. And the local anti-apartheid activists would use the Council of Churches fax machine to communicate, to get information.
What organization were you with, David?
I worked for Trinity Church Wall Street at that point, which was a very wealthy Episcopal church on Wall Street. Has more wealth than the whole rest of the Episcopal church combined because of a farm that Queen Anne gave to the church in 1700. And they own a lot of real estate in Manhattan. And when Trinity Church on Wall Street divested, you can imagine that was an unpopular move in lower Manhattan. So what they did was they said, we're not cutting and running. We're taking our money out of investments in companies doing business in South Africa, and we will invest $250,000 a year worth of grants in the role of churches to overcome apartheid. And that kept me in some contact from the outside with South Africans. So that was my background in this, from the mid-70s to the late 80s. In the 90s, I had very little contact, except when an occasional South African or two would come through and visit me in Miami. But last year, I went with my family, fulfilled a dream, and went back. We spent 5 weeks in the country, bought one hotel night, stayed in homes, rich and poor, black and white, urban and rural. Started in Pretoria, in a couple of homes that I'll mention, and came to Bloemfontein, where we stayed with Anglican bishop and dean, white church leaders, then stayed on a farm right out in the middle of the Little Karoo Desert here for a while, for a week. Went through Grahamstown. King Williamstown isn't on this map. That's where Steve Biko was born. It's about right here. And into the Transkei, spent about a week there, down through East London. Tiny little town here where I had a former student. I taught in a seminary in the Transkei here and hooked up with one of my favorite students, black priest now. And then on to Cape Town. So that's the limits of what my perspective is good for. I want to share some facts on three areas: the population, unemployment, and HIV/AIDS, just because that's important background for the context. And then I really would like to spend the bulk of our time painting portraits of some people as a way of making a case that what kind of a change has taken place. And the reason I think it's important, well, I think it's important for two reasons. I sort of suggested in the description for this session my cynicism or frustration that we focus so heavily on an issue when it's kind of in crisis, and then the minute change took place, South Africa dropped off of the map of our consideration. And that's really, that's very unfortunate for us, because I had someone at table this week say to me that, you know, they've been to the Middle East, and that when they get so discouraged about the situation in the Middle East, they try to remind themselves how much change has happened in South Africa. And that's actually very important. The degree to which change has happened in that country is worth, is important to all of us for just feeding a faith that change can happen, big changes can happen.
And that the church had a big part in it.
And that the church had a role in it, both sides. You want to know
that's true.
South Africa has a relatively young population. About 35% of the 42 million people are between the ages of 15 and 35, according to a book called Steering by the Stars, written by Mapila Rambele, who I think I mentioned earlier was at the University of Cape Town, as the head of the University of Cape Town. He is now a managing director at the World Bank. If you've seen the movie Cry Freedom, that claims to be about Biko and is really more about Donald Woods, there's a lady doctor in that movie who was friendly with Biko, was a colleague of Biko's, and that's the person, Mompila Rompelli. The population remains hopeful largely, she says, because women keep that hope alive. But it is an optimistic population in many regards, especially when you consider what they're up against. Women play the roles of single parents, they're heads of household, they're grandmothers, they're workers in the cities who support whole extended families with the wages that they earn. They're the backbone of certainly of family sustenance in South Africa. Unemployment. I have a friend who teaches at the University of Cape Town, heads of the sociology department, but used to do labor economics. And he estimated unemployment last year at 38%. Mompila, in her book, uses a figure of 45%. Any way you look at it, it's pretty severe. And generates a tremendous crime problem. Bitter white South Africans, especially those who've left the country, and by the way, most of the ones in this country left. Well, if you run into white South Africans in this country, they left. And exiles, the role of an exile is always a bitter one, whatever the circumstances are. I was struck, because a lot of white South Africans in South Florida, I know a lot of them, and I was really struck by how much more positive about the country are the ones I met in South Africa last summer, as opposed to the ones I meet in Florida. So just a word of caution about the South Africans that you have contact with in this country. There's a reason why they're here, and they've got to justify their presence. But they will say, that the ones here will say, that the country went down the drain under black rule, evidence the rising crime problem. I actually think that the rising crime was on its way well before the transition, and it's a result of just the juxtaposition of rich and poor so close to each other. And a burgeoning population growth, which for a long time was encouraged by white South Africa because it fed, it was good for their economy. They had large populations of blacks in these rural reservation areas. I've always refused to use the term the South African government gave them of homeland, because I think that's a misnomer. But scattered throughout the country, there are these pockets of black reservations. And if they were teeming with lots of people, then that was a good supply, an ample supply of cheap black labor. But the population growth has burgeoned. And Mompila Rompelli says in their book that AIDS may be successful in accomplishing what apartheid tried and never did, which was to really decimate the black population, because AIDS is a crisis. The saw an article in the paper on my way here actually, reporting on the trip through Southern Africa by Kofi Annan's special deputy for crises, and he says that the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world today is going on. Southern Africa faces the world's worst humanitarian crisis because of AIDS, hunger, and a weakened capacity to govern. Now, this is not South Africa, this is Southern Africa, which would include Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Botswana, Namibia. It's extreme. The Mompila estimated the HIV infection rates to be at 10% of the total population. The New York Times used a figure last fall of 20%. Mompila says that in the economically productive category of 15 to 35 years, it's at 25%, with young women disproportionately affected. There's a question, I think it is legitimate to raise the question whether the spread of AIDS is a reflection of the first big policy blunder of the African National Congress, the black government. A couple of reasons for that might be traditional Africa's reluctance to make any public discussion of sexuality. I don't know what the reasons are. Well, and then certainly under the current president and former deputy president of the country, Thabo Mbeki, he got a lot of press for going on record of questioning or stating that he believed that there was no evidence, no scientific evidence, that HIV causes AIDS. In any event, the government blew it. You know, you can argue they were preoccupied with other issues as they became a new government, but they have not until very recently focused on the problem, and it has just mushroomed in the last 10 years.
Right. 5 years ago, in a hospital in northern Namibia and also in Cape Town, we went into the hospitals and they would not, they said, now at the end of this corridor are a couple of people who are isolated for you know what. And they would not acknowledge it, that there was even a problem 5 years ago in the two places we were.
Right.
When I was there 2 years ago in the Transkei, they had many billboards promoting what AIDS was and how to not get it.
2 years ago. And so the public denial has begun to change. I mean, I almost wanted to shield the eyes of my children sometimes at the explicit nature of the billboards, which are now conducting a full-blown campaign. I'm not sure who's behind all of the billboards. I'm not sure that it's all government money.
No, a lot of it is civil society organizations. And in fact, Mandela has personally been the key fundraiser. I mean,
lately.
Yeah, well, in the last 2 or 3 years.
Right.
Yeah.
But in the period from 94 to 2000, the first 6 years under black leadership, you have to say that there was a failure to address this looming crisis.
But was it any more or less than in Kenya or other places?
It is more, and Mampila argues that that the population movements, the economy of South Africa is so oriented toward migrant labor, and that migrant labor, where you have patterns of migrant labor in Africa, you have the fastest spread. Men live in single-sex hostels in the urban areas, go home on their break, infect their wives, come back to work, the wives give birth. The denial that HIV might cause AIDS was used, was part of a policy not to distribute antiretroviral drugs to pregnant women, which the world learned quite a few years ahead of South Africa was a very effective way of at least stemming the spread from a pregnant mother to her newborn. And it's a huge problem, and it's certainly got the attention of the country now in a big way. And people talked about it freely all over the place, and in all kinds of ways. There are orphans all over the place. This article had an alarming statistic about the percentage of the world's HIV. About 30 million of the 40 million people worldwide infected with HIV, three quarters of them, live in sub-Saharan Africa. Average life expectancy has dropped to just 46, and there are already 11 million orphans. Now, going back to the question, certainly AIDS is a major crisis in several other African countries, some much more so than others. But the spread of it has been fastest and most recently in southern Africa, for reasons that I'm sure others are much more qualified to speak about than me. And I just want to put it on the agenda, because you can't talk about southern Africa today without referencing the fact that that's a huge issue. Now, I spent too much time this morning covering those issues, and not as much as I wanted on the portraits of people. So, if we can, let's move on to that. I'm going to start with not all that significant one, but it sets up another point I want to make. In a town called George, right about here, we stayed in a kind of a conference center situation. And the guy who was running the bar and the restaurant was probably in his mid-20s, mid to late-20s, Afrikaner, big brawny guy, a lot of swagger. You know, nobody could tell him anything until, and he, well, he wanted to tell us, we two, I started talking to him, and he was getting out. He was getting out. Not going to pay taxes to this government that has sent the country down the toilet. You know, I just don't want to pay taxes to them. So he was going to work in the cruise industry for Princess Cruises. Well, in the winter, virtually all princes, a lot of princesses' ships work out of Port Everglades. So pretty quickly he found out that we knew quite a lot about life on board the ship. So then he kind of switched from this swagger that nobody could tell him anything, and he started saying, well, you know, what are the best paying jobs on the ship? I said, the dining room, the waiters. I'm not waiting on tables. I'm not waiting on tables. I'll take less pay. I'll work in the bar. He wasn't going to take orders from anybody. And he's very bitter. And there's a lot of, particularly among the lower class and more rural whites, there's a lot of bitterness about having lost control and a pretty negative attitude toward the country. I thought of him toward the end of the visit when I read in the newspaper evidence of the recovery of an independent judiciary. Under Afrikaner rule from 1948 to 1994, the role of the judiciary, which had a proud history in South Africa, had been severely compromised and did the bidding of the nationalist government. So Biko, who's obviously beaten to death in police custody, can have a public inquest, and the evidence is so obvious that the guy was murdered in police hands, and the official ruling will be, there's no ruling. I mean, that was really what they said. There's no ruling here. We don't know what happened. The courts ruled in July of last year. They reversed a government commission. South Africa has a constitution, and one of the benefits of having a lot of people in exile who studied in the United States and Europe and all over the world was that they, a lot of them became lawyers, and a lot of them studied constitutional law. And when they came home in 1994, they wrote a heck of a constitution, a beauty, by global standards. And the constitution protects against the use of hate language. It makes it, you have a constitutional right not to be subjected to hate language. And there's an official government body that defines what is and isn't hate language. And the ANC government, which appoints the commission, had decided that a very popular slogan at ANC political rallies, kill the Boers. Boer is B-O-E-R. It's an Afrikaans word which means farmer, and it's kind of a derogatory term for white Afrikaner farmers, for Afrikaners in general. And there's a very popular slogan used in places like Soweto at political rallies, kill the Boers, kill the Boers, kill the Boers. And this government commission had decided that that was not hate language. Didn't classify as hate language, it was a slogan or something. I don't know how they justified it. But a right-wing Afrikaner group took the matter to court. And the court overruled the government commission and said this is hate language. And I thought of this guy in George, who thought the country was going down the toilet, and wondered to what degree conservative white Afrikaners appreciate that they live in a society now where minority interests can be protected by an independent judiciary, unlike what happened under the years of apartheid, where the courts did the bidding of the nationalist government. One thing that hasn't changed, and I find it, our society isn't very good at learning languages, learning foreign languages either, but language is such an important issue in South Africa. And I was interested in recovering some of my Xhosa, and I taught some of the basic, stuff, thank you, how are you, hello, I'm fine. You know, some of them are just basic greetings. We started working with the kids in the and after 5 weeks, the kids were pretty good at going back and forth. There's in African cultures generally, there's a whole routine you go through when you meet somebody, and it's more than hi, how are you. It's a little more elaborate than that. It goes back and forth several times, and my children could do that. So on the way out of the country, you know, you go through immigration and you got all the little stalls, the immigration stalls. So we get this man who turns out to be Zulu speaker, African, and he's right next to a so-called colored, which is the way South Africans refer to the mixed race group of people. And we come through, we're on our way out of the country, and by now the kids are pretty good at this exchange, and they greet him in Xhosa, not Zulu, Xhosa. And he's kind of taken by it, as everybody is, in the grocery store, or the gas station attendant, or anybody, to just show a few words, as a white, to just show a couple of words of greeting was so transformative of the relationship with any black person. They were so amazed. Where are you from? Are you really talking my language? And how could you do that as a white? Kind of thing. And the kids had this exchange with him, shocked him, and he turned to the so-called colored guy next to him and he said, "Hey, man, these kids have only been in the country a couple of weeks and they speak more Zulu than you do." Now, I'm trying to tell him it's not Zulu, and he's saying, shut up, you know. But that reflects some interest, some interesting stuff, too, that Zulus would insist that Xhosa is just a dialect of Zulu.
Right.
And Xhosas would insist that Zulu is a dialect of Xhosa. So he wanted to, and he knew very well that his neighbors didn't know the difference between the two anyway. And he gave them a hard time. That these kids, these children have only been here a few weeks and they speak more than you do. That is an issue. English is the, the question came up this morning about official languages. English is certainly the, you know, whereas it used to be English, everything was equally English and Afrikaans. It's now English and a lot of other languages get used, but I don't actually know the official government policy and when other languages are used and when they're not. Yeah. But I am surprised that there isn't more attention given to working on more education of African languages. I think it is happening in the white, in the school system now, the privileged educational system. Children get some Zulu or some Xhosa or some Tswana, depending on what part of the country they're in. And that probably promises for the future, but just the fact that it made such a huge transit impact on everybody that I would just say in course, you know, thank to the person that I had any relationship with. It would startle them to see that. I want to spend a fair amount of time talking about Barney Pichana, Barney and Dimsa Pichana, because it reflects some big changes going on. Barney was a human rights lawyer and very close colleague of Steve Biko's in the 70s, the mid-70s, who, and his wife Dimsa was very active. They had a child at that, in 77, 78, that child must have been about 8 years old. And Barney and Dimsa were both spending most of the year in detention. And under the cruelest circumstances, the police would show up in the middle of the night, carry the two of them off to separate prisons, and leave this eight-year-old child alone in the house, and then the neighbors would find them the next morning. And so when they got out of detention at one point, they decided to skip the country. And they were from Port Elizabeth, and they came into Lesotho at an Anglican convent of contemplative nuns in the mountains here, where I was staying at the time. And we spent a month in very close quarters in a guest house together and became friends. They went on to England. Barney studied theology in Oxford, got ordained, became a priest in the Church of England, served a couple of parishes, and then went to the World Council of Churches program to combat racism. where he traveled the world and they lived in Geneva. In 94, Mandela asked Barney to come back and head the Human Rights Commission of the government. Now, he spent 24 hours with me in Miami once, traveling from Rio to New Delhi. He'd been at a conference in Rio and was going to one in New Delhi and did a 24-hour tour in Miami. And I was so fascinated by his stories about the challenge of teaching people their constitutional rights, which I would sort of take for granted. You know, we all get it in eighth grade civics class or something. But here's a majority population that have never had constitutional rights, and most of them probably are illiterate. And Barney's in charge of teaching them their constitutional rights. And he talked about some of the campaigns and how you went about that. Port Elizabeth is an ANC stronghold. That's where he's from. He was born into the ANC. He'll always be a member of the ANC. He worked in the ANC government until the year 2000, when the governing council of the University of South Africa, UNISA, asked him to be its first black principal. That might be 2001, maybe 2002, something like that. UNISA is the largest, it pioneered what we call distance education, correspondence courses. That phenomenon was really pioneered globally by UNISA. And UNISA is today one of 11 mega universities in the world that do, they call it distance teaching. And I'm amazed I was amazed to hear from him the intricacy with which the science that they've made out of it. How do they validate their testing? And how do they develop their curriculum? And how do they communicate with their students, so forth and so on. Now, what's interesting about his appointment, we stayed with them when we landed, first few days. And then everywhere we went thereafter for the rest of the trip, people would say, well, where have you been on this trip? And we would cite that. And, that was a big controversy. He was in the papers for months. It was a huge national controversy between the ANC government and the university over who controlled the university. And the government, Ministry of Education, actually tried to argue that the governing council of UNISA did not have the right to appoint its principal. And it was a major test, really boiled down to the independence of the university. The reason the government didn't want Barney's appointment to go ahead was they were embarking on a policy that encouraged institutions of higher learning to merge with each other. And we saw, there was often talk in the newspapers about this as we moved around the country, that the cost of higher education was so great that they had to seek the efficiencies of larger scale. And they didn't want any appointments to be made until after, I mean, they felt that they could do their merging work as a government better if there wasn't a principal in place at UNISA. UNISA had been a major bastion of Afrikanerdom, from its architecture in Pretoria, which was the capital of Afrikanerdom up here, to its curriculum, to its faculty. It was an Afrikaner institution for 50 years prior to this. And it's significant that the university won, and that an ANC man, a former government official, succeeded through the courts at defeating the government effort to take control of the institution. And Barney is very articulate on the importance of private education, private institutions that are not, that the health of a civil society depends on power being spread out, power and influence in lots of corners. And that the more it's concentrated in one government that's dominated by one party, the less democratic the society will end up being. Last year they were celebrating, UNISA was celebrating its 130th anniversary. And Barney had gotten very creative about some of the ways that they did this. For example, they held a series of special commencement ceremonies. The Deputy Minister of Education had been a UNISA student while in exile and never been allowed to graduate. And there were people up and down the country who, Mandela or others on Robben Island, who had studied through correspondence to get their degrees, completed all their requirements, but because for political reasons or for racial reasons, never been allowed to graduate. You know, there are people, I was told that sometimes the university didn't know until it came time for graduation what the race of their student was. But on graduation day, they didn't want it messed up, you know, in an apartheid order, you don't want too many brown or black faces in the crowd there. And so they held these special commencement ceremonies to finally award degrees to people who had been denied them, for the humanitarian value of that, but also as a way of helping the university connect with its history, be realistic about its history. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, called TRC, which has done such an amazing process of truth-telling. Not justice rendering, and there's some rumblings about that, you know, especially if you're part of a family that had a family member killed, you want justice. But the society basically took the position that it's more important that the truth come out than that justice be done. And where we can't have both, we'll weigh in on the side of truth telling. And that has had a major impact, especially on the whites, I think, who, you know, you can always argue. Some people want to say that you got to work pretty hard not to be aware of the stuff that goes on, but at the same time, look at our own society. When I listened to South Africans talk about how they weren't aware of what was going on under apartheid, I thought, you know, I could see the day in my lifetime when America, when everybody in the United States claimed that they didn't know what was going on in Israel. We had no idea what our role was there, and how awful was, how despicable was that role, how unjust was that role. So I'm not sure it's so that you have to work so hard not to be aware. I think that societies are set up, Western societies are set up in a way that can pretty easily hide the truth. Now, I'm not saying you can't find out the truth in our society, but it's not that easy to. It's pretty easy to ignore it if you want to. And a lot of that went on in South Africa, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission helped some South Africans, you know, read through testimony that came up over and over again in case after case after case, that, you know what, we had a government that sponsored assassination squads, and we did torture, and we killed people in detention, and they weren't all communists who were killing themselves, kind of stuff. That came out, and is very significant. And this these special commencements helped some people realize that this university they were so proud of had weighed in on the side of apartheid. The second night we're there, they was the one night of the year's worth of celebrations when they had a big gala dinner. Tremendous music. I was so hungry to hear some South African music. And here's Ivan Chaka Chaka and Hugh Masekela and the third band, you know, on the stage, and fine South African wines. And a room full of people, black and white, dignitaries from some of the consulates and some of the foundations that supported UNISA, and white women in African clothing. The politically correct dress code for a formal affair like this in South Africa now says black tie or traditional dress. And you can come either way. You know, you come in traditional African dress or... And Ivan Chaka Chaka getting white men up on the stage to dance. It was remarkable for me. I mean, she got the ex-chancellor of the university up on the stage, kind of awkward, but he was doing it. And whites were were being led up to that stage, and they were trying to dance in an African way, and Africans were dancing with them, of course. I felt, I just arrived in the country, so I wasn't accustomed to this new South Africa at all yet. I hadn't been there since the change, and I was used to the South Africa where I'd moved in white circles and in black circles, and almost like a schizophrenic, never connected the two. So I wasn't surprised to hear black speakers, the deputy state president and the minister of education, who impressed us tremendously, and Barney, the principal of the university. I wasn't surprised to hear these people use phrases like the savagery of apartheid. But I had never heard such talk in the company of white South Africans. And I sensed in myself real fast a tension, like, uh-oh. You know, these worlds are not supposed to connect. And they were connecting. And I felt nervous. And I was seated next to, I had Melusi Mpumwana and Toko on one side, and on this side were an Afrikaner couple. He had been in the administration of UNICEF for 23 years on Skolkiks. And had been the executive assistant to the principal under the previous administration, and now he was relegated. I'd asked him, well, what do you do in the university? And he was kind of embarrassed, and it was some outpost low, you know, I didn't, but he really wanted to talk about what he used to do in the university, which was a much more prominent role. And at one point, I just said to them, excuse me for prying here, but I'm shocked to hear you applauding some of these speeches. To what degree do you own this language? And he was a little harder for him to do it, but his wife was right there. We do own it. She said, you know, we had never been in Soweto until the election, the first election, and we volunteered to do poll watching. And it was the first time we went into Soweto. We had no idea what was going on in Soweto or what it was like. And we talked with her quite a bit in the course of the meal. Them. And at one point she said, with her husband there, we're very optimistic about the future. Maybe we're too optimistic, but it's better that way. And in a nutshell, that summed up for me a lot of white South African attitudes. Not the lower class whites or the rural farmers who are bitter, but certainly the better educated and the more middle class white population, I think, is excited about discovering Africa. Barney talked about the role of UNISA, his vision for UNISA, and making it a center of education for Africa. That same week we were with them, 20 representatives, high-level academic or university leaders from 22 African countries were brought in by UNISA for no purpose other than to just talk about the distance teaching phenomenon and how it works and how they do it. And Barney was explaining to me that throughout much of Africa over the last 10 or 20 years, as budgets have shrunken, one easy place for governments to balance the budget is to gut higher education. And the universities that once dotted the map in Africa are really in trouble. And so UNISA is reaching out, working with those universities, trying to be a resource to the rest of Africa. Whites in South Africa, who, when their backs were against the wall, always wanted to tell you they were African, you know, and don't tell us how to run our societies, we're African, really spent a lot of intellectual and mental energy trying to forget the fact that Africa separated them from Europe and North America. And they really looked to Europe and North America. Evidence the Visiting Scholars Program at UNISA, which Barney said inevitably always brought in academics from the United States and Europe. And so when he came in and he saw this, he said, well, why don't you bring in some African scholars? Oh, well, they don't exist at the skill level that we need. And so having been at the Parker McMahon Racism with the World Council of Churches and moved around the world a lot, he said, go check this database and check with this group and check with... He said, I gave him about four groups to check with. I said, you look for scholars there and then come back and tell me what you thought. And he said these white department heads came back and said, whoa, it's amazing, some of the people that we're finding in Africa. And he said, exactly. So he now refuses to approve a visiting scholar from Europe or North America until they've proven to him that they've checked all these other sources and can't find one in Africa. The whites who are having this experience are getting excited. How can you not get excited about discovering African music and some African foods? And if you're a scholar, finding out that the continent has been untapped, unknown, and they're beginning to discover it, and South Africa is beginning to play a major leading role on the continent in a way that it never could as a pariah state.
And the advancement of African culture.
Culture, scholarship, politics. Thabo Mbeki is a real leader in the New Economic Partnership for Africa's Development, NEPAD. You don't think he's a leader, or you don't believe in NEPAD?
I think NEPAD has some problems, but that's...
Yeah, but I think NEPAD is certainly a step ahead of its predecessor bodies.
Yeah.
And, you know, it reflects an effort on the part of Africa to move ahead, and there was a lot of optimism about it, and a lot of on the part of some people. And optimism is a good thing, you know, even if there's too much of it. It's like that white woman. It's better that way that we're optimistic. I mean, they have made a decision to stay, and so the only way they can go forward with it is in the best possible way.
Do you have any sense of how many white South Africans have moved abroad, especially academics and artists and people who felt that they didn't really have much of a future because the places they would have wanted to take now were going to be taken by black Africans. And I've met a lot, I mean, every place that we've lived, we've met a lot of expatriate South Africans. White South Africans, and it's always an interesting conversation because they don't speak ill of the country, saying, you know, isn't this terrible that I've had to go elsewhere. It's often and most often been in terms of the time, you know, it's the times now, and this is really what has to happen there now. And so there is not a place for me to pursue my professional life there as I would have liked, because others need that chance.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a more progressive attitude than the ones who are bitter and just said there's too much crime and I'm not going to raise my children there. I did meet whites who complained about the fact that, you know, when jobs are open, the policy is to promote a lesser qualified black rather than a better qualified white. And there's got to be some frustration for some whites to work under that. Then there's always the gray area. You know, is this person lesser qualified or not? And who's doing the evaluation? That's going on. That's going to be inevitable. How else do you get leaders? It's sort of like the same phenomenon happened in this country with women's rights and the policies that promoted more black opportunity, for example. I don't have data on how big. I did see something. I remember an article that we referenced that tried to raise in alarmist certain terms. Maybe it was a speech from a white MP or something talking about the brain drain and how many white South Africans are leaving. It is a very significant number, and if I recall the article correctly, it suggested that, you know, the number was creeping up there. It wasn't going down. And more people were leaving each year rather than less. Certainly the government's official policy is to hang on. And they worked very hard in the agricultural sector. The Minister of Agriculture is white. And they worked hard to hang on to the productivity of the white dominated agricultural society. Although they've also taken actions there. they quickly decided that probably the most exploited group of workers in the country were farm workers. And they set minimum standards of working conditions and pay. The farm we stayed on, the guy laughed at it. He said, you know, we had way better conditions and were paying significantly more than that at the time that it happened. But some of the lower, you know, I mean, they're exceptional people. And a lot of farms found that a bitter pill to swallow. Mary.
I'm very interested in how the Truth and Reconciliation started, because, I mean, I can't imagine us in the United States settling for truth instead of justice. And I just remember going into this one church in Cape Town, a black church, where the pastor said, now is the time for laying on of hands and for healing. Those of you that have had family members who were tortured or have been tortured yourself in some way, please come forward. And a third of the 600 people in that church got up and with their arms around one another, and the two or three pastors that were there laid hands on all these people. And I can't imagine that they didn't want, I mean, what? How did that ever come about, that they would settle for truth and not justice? I think that is amazing.
I don't know, so hear me, I don't know. But I think that it was Mandela who approached Tutu and said, we need to do this. There are some examples of it in, I'm trying to think, where else has it happened?
Well, it's starting to happen in Rwanda and Sierra Leone.
Yeah, but before,
before.
I think, didn't it happen in Central America?
Guatemala,
somewhere?
Was that?
In Guatemala?
I don't know, I'm trying to think. No. Nicaragua?
Was it maybe Nicaragua?
Argentina.
Yeah, I think so. I think it happened in differently in South Africa, and more. You know, I've read that this is the most profound example of it. But Mandela is just an extraordinary blessing to humanity. He really. And you move through the country, the white farm that we stayed on, they had immense respect for Mandela. And they were very cynical about Mbeki. You know, just the difference in attitude on the part of whites toward Mandela versus Mbeki is night and day. And I'm convinced that Mandela's charisma, you know, worked on his captors and moved them to take a chance and release him. He's just a rare, very rare human. I don't say that about everybody. Some of you know that I'm fairly critical of Tutu, but Mandela I hold in the highest regard.
How did the Zulus fit into all this?
They brought Gacha Buthelezi into the cabinet, but he's been nothing but a misfit there, really. And he doesn't have a lot of power. I didn't go to Zululand. I'm really not qualified to speak on that. Through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it came out that a lot of what was claimed to be black versus black violence during the heat of the struggle was actually whites working through Zulu leaders to foment trouble. So, but that's an uneasy member of the government's coalition, I would say. I want to, listen, I know I've been doing a lot of talking here, and there's going to be some questions, but there's a couple of things I want to get at. I want to talk a little bit about the churches. There has been a dramatic shift from a Christian nationalist government to a government that officially says we're treating all religions the same. In a way, it would be instructive for those who would like to see a more Christian government, official government in this country. You know, the supporters of Bush should take heed how that can come back to swing the pendulum the other way. I mean, I think the ANC government is very much aware of the dangers of a Christian nationalist state, and the pendulum swung far back. Somebody asked me at dinner night, well, how many of the people in South Africa are Christians? It's certainly the majority, I think, of the urban area. Rural, it's harder to read. How many are Christians there, and how many would follow traditional African religion. I felt a much stronger presence of Hinduism and Islam. And I don't know if that's because the numbers are greater or because they've been allowed to come out of the woodwork and, you know, be there. Port ministries that were sanctioned under the Christian nationalist government. Now the ports are state-owned and state-controlled, and the state doesn't provide any support to the religion. Religion departments at universities have taken a big hit in a way that they used to not have. Second, just tidbit. My former student, I told you, we went and saw outside of Port Elizabeth, is a black priest in charge of an Anglican area, maybe a half an hour between some of his parishes. The assistant rector is white. But he lives in the former assistant rector's house, and the assistant rector, who's white, lives in the rector's house because that's in a white neighborhood, and he lives in a black neighborhood. And I was prodding Malusi about that. He said, yeah, but the difference is that he has a choice now. I'm not sure he really has much of a choice. But it is significant that he's the rector, and he was treated and respected, and I preached for him in both congregations, white and black. And he was respected as the rector in the white congregation. But and there's some Africanizing of the liturgy a little bit. But some issues are going to take longer to change than others. We visited out in the remote Transkei area a group of Anglican nuns, St. John the Baptist sisters. No electricity, no running water at the convent in the buildings. Really poor, poorly resourced community, taking in AIDS orphans into their convent. It's kind of curious to see these nuns mothering these children of all ages, from an infant one-year-old to 12-year-old girls. I would always ask church leaders, and we saw half a dozen bishops or so, what's the biggest challenge to your ministry faces? And more often than not, they said, unemployment, AIDS. And I thought I'd be hard-pressed to meet too many church leaders in this country that would identify non-ecclesial issues as their biggest challenge. I thought it was really healthy that they were focused on big social issues like that. And the Kairos document, how many of you know the Kairos document that came out of South African Township? I went to church with Malusi in a black, Xhosa-speaking Johannesburg suburb. The congregation was upper middle class, well-educated blacks. And he started referencing the Kairos document. He said, how many people know what the Kairos document is? And only one other hand besides mine went up. There was just no familiarity with it. That shocked me. Until Malusi explained later, well, what do you expect, you know? From the time the Kairos document came out until the time a black government came in, we had 15 years, it was 15, no, it's less, 10 years of state, you know, of apartheid control. And this kind of stuff was banned and illegal. And it just didn't disseminate.
What's the Kairos document?
It was a radical statement of black theology that came out, not black theology, a radical theological statement that was born out of urban township violence in the mid-80s. There's copies of it in the resource library here, and it's a very, I've learned a lot about how to read the Bible, reread the Bible from that statement. It was when Moses says, and he taught the congregation about it in his sermon that morning. He said, when we were burying people faster than we could keep up with, some people from the urban townships in South Africa started meeting together and debating and talking about it. And they came out with things like an explanation of that chapter in Romans, which says the leaders are God ordained and you have to obey them. And they explained what the antinomian controversy was all about and what that really meant, and that it didn't mean that the Bible is telling you to support unjust government leaders. And they talked about, we have to forgive those who sin against us, but forgiveness presumes repentance. And where there's no repentance, forgiveness is a little premature. And they talked very powerfully about violence, the role of violence. It's worth looking at. I just want to mention here that it was a shock to me that it was unknown. You go to Robben Island, I'm sure many of you have seen or read or know that Robben Island, which was the political prison right outside of Cape Town, has been turned into a museum. I knew that. I didn't know that ex-warders, ex-guards, prison guards, and ex-prisoners run that museum side by side. And you hear that it's just extraordinary. You take the tour from, an ex-political prisoner takes you on the tour through Robben Island, and they tell you outrageous stories about what the guards did to them. And then they point out to you, that guy who drove the boat, drove you out here in the boat, he was one of my guards. It's extraordinary, the way they lived together like that. I'm going to end with a quote, but not till I point out that I think the proximity with which rich and poor lived together in South Africa puts the wealthier South Africans a huge step ahead of Americans. Marie and I debated regularly because she started driving around the country and seeing these townships, and she got angry, which is her nature of just get angry in the face of injustice. And for me, I saw, God, the townships have got, they're electrified now, and they got roads paved, so I'm thinking, they're getting better. And she was outraged that people could live in a white town, and here was this black township, and the disparity was so extreme. And I kept saying, Maria, this is true of us, too. We just don't see it. The world that we live in and depend upon lives like black South Africans do in those townships, but it's so far removed from our line of sight, that in a way we're worse off than the white South Africans who live much closer to it and have it kind of in their face, the way the world lives. We're out of time, you can tell I'm racing here. But just to, by the way, this book of Steve Biko's writings, which I'm going to read from right now, is available in the bookstore and will be the subject of a whole session on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. And it's not from Southern Africa, but I highly recommend the political history found in the Poisonwood Bible, this novel. It is very accurate. It claims to be fiction, but what it says about the U.S. role in Belgian Congo in the early 60s is quite true, and in my experience, a story that is not very, very rare to find in full. Steve Biko talking about the role of that blacks had to offer a new South Africa someday, one that he didn't obviously live to see, wrote at the end of a chapter called Black Consciousness and the Quest for a True Humanity. We've set out on a quest for true humanity, and somewhere on the distant horizon we can see the glittering prize. Let us march forth with courage and determination, drawing strength from our common plight and our brotherhood. In time, we shall be in a position to bestow upon South Africa the greatest gift possible, a more human face. And I have to believe that the people working on that that new, building that new South Africa, in spite of the problems, carry an optimism that really believe they are a part of that kind of a big enterprise. And it's one that we would do well to tune into, because that night at the gala dinner, and there's all this optimism, there's a recognition that we've come through a dark night, and this institution has been part of some pretty despicable policies, but here's the vision we have that we're going to go forward with. And it was so positive and exciting. In the middle of the dinner, Maria turned to me, and she doesn't drink, so it wasn't the wine, and said to me, let's move here. And I thought to myself, I wasn't aware until I got here how pessimistic and fearful my own society has become about its future. South Africans showed me how worried I have become about my future by the stark contrast of their optimism about their future. And I recommend it to all of you any way you can get it. So let's go to Vespers.
Thank you.